Good evening and welcome to South Sudan and Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi, in for John Tanza. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Thursday, July 18th, 2024. An activist at the Kenyan-sponsored South Sudan peace talks says opposition and government delegates should address important issues affecting South Sudanese.
What we want is for the parties to accept the truth and do the right thing. This is our principle. If they accept the truth of the situation in the country and they do the right thing, then we will be okay with them. And that is why we are not speaking.
And local traders in South Sudan's capital say foreign vendors have taken over local businesses in the country.
I went to Konyokonyo at some point, and it was exclusively Ugandans selling food, selling avocados, selling bananas, selling Irish potato. And I was asking myself, can the South Sudan government come up with a protection mechanism that allows South Sudanese to be the one selling these things?
We'll have those stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. And for our top story, some residents of South Sudan's capital, Juba, are complaining about an increasing number of foreign vendors along the city streets and markets. They are concerned the foreign vendors pose an economic threat to South Sudanese traders. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
Scopas Betwell, who lives in a Juba suburb, says South Sudan is turning into a chaotic market for foreigners who are involved in all sorts of businesses across the country. He says the government should open a market at the border with Uganda for foreign vendors who wants to invest in the country.
I went to Konyokonyo at some point, and it was exclusively Ugandans selling fruit, selling avocados, selling bananas, selling Irish potato, including green pepper. And I was asking myself, can the South Sudan government come up with a protection mechanism that allows South Sudanese to be the one selling these things? Because that's how you allow your people to grow economically.
Many foreign businesses rushed to South Sudan in 2011 after the country got independence from Sudan. Since then, business opportunities in the country have attracted traders from Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya, Somalia, Eritrea, and Egypt. Neal Todd, another Juba resident, says the large number of foreign vendors poses a threat to local traders who are struggling to stay in business.
Nowadays, many Ethiopians just came with their empty hand, with their empty back. Coming to South Sudan that they are the business people, which is not true. We need to identify those who are coming to our country. What kind of business are they going to come and conduct? For my opinion, we can only allow those who may come and invest carrying their own money, deposit them in our central bank, then regulated them to avoid inflation in our economy.
Scopas says the people of South Sudan have no government protection to prevent local businesses from collapsing.
As a South Sudanese, I feel we South Sudanese have never had enough protection from our authorities, from the government, to be able to grow. I think we open our doors to the neighboring countries or to foreign nationals rather too soon, in my opinion. We needed to first develop policies that will help us grow rapidly. We needed to have monetary policies that support, that provide loans to our people, develop our cooperative societies, develop our banks that will be able to give out loans.
Tiktik Mayardit, deputy mayor for social service in Juba City Council, says South Sudan has laws in place to regulate foreigners conducting businesses in the country, but they are not enforced.
But now, if we talk to them as a people of city council and tell them that this is not supposed to be done in this way, you are caught in another way. Because these are the people which are supposed to bring us the law which they are having there so that we come and implement them. And we empowered our people in that sector so that our people can understand. Not because we don't like the foreigners, but this is not the time now. They should come to us.
Tick calls on relevant government agencies to defend the interests of local traders. Viola Melka sells ladies' clothes in Juba. She says vendors like her faces challenges and that the foreign traders in the city pose unnecessary competition for local traders.
We are facing a lot of challenges inside there. But now what can we do as a citizen? There is nothing, because even sometimes even our landlord want to remove us from the shop to give it to foreigners because they pay much money. Even me myself, when I went to city council to go and talk to the director, to the person that is collecting money for rubbish, the director told me, you know, I prefer foreigners better than you people, our citizens, because when we come, we want money, you will always give us excuse. So if someone like that refuse to listen to you, whom do you think that will listen to us as citizens?
South Sudan's Ministry of Interior grants work permits for foreigners operating businesses in South Sudan. But some residents and local traders say the process of acquiring work permits have been abused by foreigners who use inappropriate avenues to obtain papers for their businesses. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias reporting from Juba.
Delegates at the Kenya-sponsored South Sudan talks in Nairobi say the gathering is going through a crisis after SPLM-IO, loyal to the country's first vice president, Riek Machar, recalled its team at the talks. Quer Aguirre-Cuella, former governor of the northern Bahar El Ghazal state and a civil society activist with the People Coalition for Civic Action, tells my colleague John Tanza that the delegates at the talks should forget their differences and focus on the search for peace in South Sudan.
There is no direct responsibility for IO to call the component part of the government delegation that is in the talk back to IO, because they did not come as IO representatives, but they came as a delegation of the government. And that is one of the issues that the IO political bureau need to be aware of, this, that they are not delegates. They don't have delegate direct from IO. It is a government delegation. That is one. Two, for him to be able to call back whoever he thinks is his member, he has to do it through the president, because the delegation was formed through an order or decree from the president of the Republic of South Sudan, who is the head of government of the revitalized government of National Unity. So it should be through president that he can call back his team. What is genuine about it, about the IO, was to seek for clarity. This thing is not clear, we don't understand this, and we don't know that, so that they are made aware. And if there are concerns, they have to raise it within the context of the government. They have to raise it in the presidency. And then the presidency will take decision whether they have to give directives or not. But the way he started it, I don't think that is the right way of doing it, because IO is not a participant in the mine initiative.
What are some of the implications of this move by First Vice President Riek Machar recalling his party members from the Tumaini initiative? Any implications that you see?
It shows clearly that there is a build up within the government, that there are blocks or group of people who are not happy with this process, and they want to undermine it in a way, or they want to discredit it as not a good process for South Sudan. But the most important thing is for them to be made aware of what is happening. They need to get it right, and they need to reflect on it, because the hard actor has not been able to bring peace for the last 9 years, starting from 2015. For the last 9 years, it has not been able to bring sustainable peace, and there is no transition to democracy, which is the end game of the whole agreement that was signed. There is a need to link up between the Tumaini and Araxa.
Yeah, when I read Riek Machar's letter, he said the six protocols that the delegates at the Tumaini initiative initialed is a copycat of the, you know, the revitalized agreement for the resolution of conflict in South Sudan, and his fear is that some of these protocols might override the progress made so far. What is your reaction to that?
I don't think there is an override of this. What is happening is to continue, because if you remember, there was a committee that reviewed the roadmap, because when the parties failed to implement the RFS, they bring it down into roadmap. Critical issues that need to be implemented for the country to transit to democracy. Again, there was a failure. There are things that are still pending. There are things that are in progress, and so on. So these critical aspects need to be carried over into the implementation matrix that is going to happen, so that we can actually move very quickly to reach the state of election. And if they don't see themselves in the mirror of next stage in the country, then they have every right to worry, but they should be sure.
Your presence at the Tumaini Talks in Nairobi is on behalf of the civilian population, because you are a civil society activist. Is there anything of concern to you that you would like to bring it to the attention of South Sudanese?
There was a tendency to give the government and opposition upper hand in the process, to be the one negotiating, and very much that the other actors should play a role of bridging gap between the two parties. But for us as PCC, we said no, we are not bridge-making. We are people who have a clear vision of how things should be addressed in the country. And therefore, we cannot play that gap. What we want is for the party to accept the truth and do the right thing. This is our principle. If they accept the truth of the situation in the country and they do the right thing, then we will be okay with them. And that is why we are not seeking participation in the government. Because if we go in, there will be no way for us to raise issues that are not going right. So this is what we have seen, and we are working now. The situation has changed. We participate in most of the talks of the stakeholders, opposition, government. We sit in some talks, and we try to work together to find something new and something different from what we used to have in hard access.
Officials in Chad say urgent international help is needed to save more than 2 million people caught in a severe humanitarian crisis caused by conflicts and climate shocks. Chad is among the poorest nations in the world, but is home to more than 1 million displaced people, including 600,000 refugees from neighboring Sudan and the Central African Republic. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Cameroon.
The Central African nation of Chad, now experiencing its fifth consecutive year of severe food insecurity, launched a call Monday for a national emergency response program to help millions of vulnerable people. Officials say food is particularly scarce now as hunger peaks in the June to August lean season between harvests. Abdelmajid Abderrahim is Chad's Minister of Public Health. He says he is pleading with all international partners to help Chad out of a severe humanitarian crisis affecting over 2 million civilians in the country of about 18 million people. Abderrahim says ceaseless floods and influx of refugees, increasing numbers of displaced persons and armed conflicts between communities are inflicting sufferings on civilians. Chad's government alone, despite its strong will and commitment, cannot meet the growing needs of suffering people alone. Abderrahim, speaking on Chad State TV on Monday, described the food insecurity and humanitarian crisis as unprecedented. He said the crises are exacerbated by insufficient agricultural production due to climate change, drought, and an influx of destructive migratory birds and crickets. Chad hosts over 600,000 refugees displaced from conflict-ridden Sudan, and their numbers and humanitarian needs are growing. Chad is also home to tens of thousands of civilians fleeing fighting between rebels and government troops in the Central African Republic. Several hundred thousand civilians displaced in Chad by Boko Haram terrorism are also in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. Added to that are the millions of people affected by floods and drought that hit Chad hard over the past year. Last week, the World Bank said Chad was requesting assistance to save several million lives threatened by hunger and malnutrition. Rassist Pertev is the representative of the World Bank in Chad.
Chad has seized the Bank Mondiale for an inactivation.
Pertev says the World Bank is contributing $60 million to help Chad's government cope with the food emergency the Central African State declared all over its territory. He says he hopes the contribution from the World Bank will help Chad to immediately respond to the crisis and save lives. The World Bank says it will mobilize an additional $100 million to assist a government response plan. Last week, the World Food Programme, the World Bank, the European Commission, Japan, and the United States said they are also contributing to help Chad by distributing food, seeds, and sharing cash transfers to families most exposed to hunger. They said the program will target the most affected provinces, including Enugu East, Wadi Fira, Kwadai, Sila Logon Oriental, Lak, Kanem, and Bahr El Ghazal on the border with Sudan. Foreign donors did not say how much they will be giving to assist Chad in the emergency response plan. The plan also envisages the provision of nutritional supplements for children under two, pregnant women, and breastfeeding mothers who the UN says are most impacted by hunger and malnutrition. The World Food Programme says to reduce the increasingly severe and recurrent crisis, substantial investments in agriculture and support to reduce climate shocks should be intensified. Reinforcing the purchasing power of the most vulnerable populations is also a key to improving living conditions, the WFP adds. The World Bank reports that poverty and vulnerability are pervasive in Chad, with over 42% of the population living below the national poverty line. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The United States ambassador to the United Nations said the U.S. will give an extra $203 million for civilians affected by the conflict in Sudan. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield made a call on Thursday, urging on other nations to step up their aid. The funds, announced in a statement to Reuters News, aim to support civilians in Sudan and those who have fled to neighboring countries since the conflict erupted in April 2023 between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. UN agencies and other organizations say there is a realistic chance of famine in 14 areas across Sudan if the conflict escalates. The UN World Food Programme has called it the worst hunger crisis in the world. The additional U.S. money takes the total American funding for Sudanese civilians in Sudan, Chad, Egypt, and South Sudan to $707 million since October, a U.S. official said. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, world remembers the legacy of Nelson Mandela on his birthday. Find out why after the break. Today, the world is commemorating Nelson Mandela International Day, designated by the United Nations to honor the world struggle icon. South Africa, Mandela, born on the 18th of July 1918 and died on the 5th of December 2013. And as the world reflects on his legacy, Tuso Kumalo visits Robben Island, where Mandela was imprisoned for 18 years.
People from across the world visit Robben Island daily to learn more about Nelson Mandela, a man loved by many. Madiba, as he is popularly known, spent 18 years on this island which South Africa's apartheid government turned into an isolation prison. His crime was that he fought for the liberation of his country from the oppressive apartheid system. The island now is a museum. Visitors can see the quarry where Mandela and other political prisoners were forced to dig and the rocks they were compelled to break to exhaust their strength and crush their determination to fight apartheid. His prison cell, furnished with a small bench, a blade, a cup, a bucket for a toilet, and thin blankets, is a reminder of the sacrifice he made for democracy, human rights, and freedom. Ncedisi Siswana was also brought to this prison in the late 1970s.
It was tough because we found ourselves in an environment where the prison guards were all white and the prisoners were all black. And so the prison warders didn't treat us in a very humane manner. So we had to assert ourselves and assert our dignity, you know, as human beings.
He describes Mandela as a rare human being who did not allow his circumstances to change him.
Madiba was a person who listened even to those people with whom he disagreed. And he would always do his best to try and project humanity to the other person, with the hope that that person would reciprocate that.
Mandela's sacrifice, along with that of others, finally bore fruit in February 1990, when he was released after a total of 27 years in prison. He became South Africa's first black president after apartheid officially ended in 1994. He surprised many in his inauguration speech when he embraced his former oppressors in the new South Africa, which he called a rainbow nation.
Never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another and suffer the indignity of being the scum of the world.
Wendy Mutuma, a tour guide at Robben Island, says she is proud of the South Africa that Mandela created and left for them.
Today we find that we in South Africa are very diverse. We are very accepting of everybody into this port of humanity.
As the world reflects on the icon's life, Siswana says the only way to honor Mandela is for justice, peace, and equality to reign in the whole world. Reporting for VOA News at South Africa's Robben Island, I am Thuso Khumalo.
New research from climate scientists says that annual temperature increases in Southern Africa have doubled compared with elsewhere in the world. Darren Teller reports.
7 years ago, a model from the Southern Africa Science Service Center for Climate Change predicted a future of weather chaos for the region as temperatures rise. Only a few authorities paid much attention, says the organization's director, Dr. Jane Olwatch. Scientists like Olwatch have shown that burning fossil fuels generates greenhouse gas emissions, which act like a blanket around the Earth, trapping the sun's heat and raising temperatures. Last year, the World Meteorological Organization said average global temperatures were nearly 1.5 degrees Celsius higher than in pre-industrial times. Olwatch's latest revised model says Southern Africa, already one of the region's worst affected by climate change, will see temperatures rise faster than in much of the world. Higher temperatures have caused human suffering, weather changes, droughts, and stronger, deadly tropical cyclones.
It's clearly predicted that as we go into the future, first of all, we know it's getting warmer, but also it's getting drier. And of course, we have also experienced droughts and water shortages and reduction in food yields. These drastic, unexpected events are the common occurrence. So, of course, there are other issues that are responsible for those, including land use and land cover change. But climate change has got a good percentage in the contribution to these extreme events.
She says countries experiencing what she calls serious weather upheaval include Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. University of KwaZulu-Natal climate change expert Professor Tafadzwa Mbahudi says annual temperatures in southern Africa are rising by almost 3 degrees Celsius, also with tragic consequences.
A warmer climate stores more moisture. A warmer climate also means more energy to drive storms or storm systems. A warmer climate also means higher temperatures and heat waves. And it also means that fires can start and spread more easily.
South Africa is being hit hard now by weather extremes, with scores of people killed this year. Wildfires are sweeping parts of the country, blamed by scientists on record high winter temperatures that left vast grasslands dry. At the same time, the Cape coastal areas are being lashed by rainstorms, causing floods that have left thousands of people homeless.
The unusual thing this time around is they had them in succession, one after the other. So if you have heavy rainfall, it saturates the soil. And any further heavy rainfall after that would mean now you are having localized flooding because you've exceeded your drainage.
Mbahudi says no country in southern Africa is prepared for the weather expected to hit the region in the future.
Every time we have this inclement weather, it is associated with death, destruction, which means we need to bring in significant international climate finance, you know, infrastructure being made climate resilient, because in many systems we require infrastructure overhauls to redesign our infrastructure, to repurpose our infrastructure. We need significant investments in rehabilitating the natural environment so that it can play its role in protecting the coastline, training people and government officials in disaster management so that they're able to take proactive action to reduce the impact of these disasters.
But so far, he says, he sees little movement in that direction from regional governments. In the absence of action, says Mbahudi, southern Africa will face a future filled with natural disasters, which will erode economies, causing more poverty. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that's all we prepared for you this Thursday, July the 18th, 2024. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. And if you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. And now we leave you with Todi by Oliver Mutukuzi. We've been listening to Todi by Oliver Mtukuzi and your host Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.